thank you very much. We structure these forums so that after our principal speaker gives their perspective as combatant commander, we have a panel of experts who can burrow deeper into some of the issues from the perspective of regional experts, the media, the U.S. Congress, and we have a terrific panel today. We're going to spend about half an hour and sort of exchange views on what we heard, what we think bears further elaboration. Then we'll open it up. People can comment. I'll take two questions. My dad's in the Coast Guard Auxiliary, so I'll give you a pass. to my left here is Frank Januzzi, who is the senior East Asia advisor for the Democratic staff of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Frank is an old Asia hand. He's lived in Japan. He's a China expert. He served in the Bureau of Intelligence and Research in the State Department and is one of, if not the most, important staffer on Asia-Pacific issues in the U.S. Congress. Randy Shriver, a friend, former colleague from government, is one of the founding partners of the international consulting firm Armitage International and is the CEO and president of a think tank established last year called the 2049 Institute, which does long-range strategic analysis and projections on Asia-Pacific political and security issues. Randy served with great distinction in the State Department as Chief of Staff for Deputy Secretary Armitage and as the Deputy Assistant Secretary in charge of China, Mongolia, Taiwan. And then James Kitfield, who is the National Security and Foreign Affairs Correspondent for the National Journal, a very respected, independent, and authoritative journal. He's won a number of prizes, including this year the Gerald R. Ford Prize for Distinguished Reporting on National Defense. I'm Mike Green. I'm from CSIS, the Japan chair here, and I work on broader Asia issues. Was in government with Randy during the Bush administration. I was the senior director for Asia at the National Security Council staff. Let me open up by asking each of you, going down the line with Frank first. First, I should emphasize this is not a roast of Admiral Keating, especially since he's not here. That wouldn't be any fun. What we really want to do is elaborate on key insights he had, highlight things that were perhaps not mentioned, flag things that were maybe surprising or different from past statements from the Pacific Command. But I want to ask each of you initially what struck you, what you think bears further elaboration, and we'll start with Frank.
Thanks very much, Michael, and it's my great pleasure to be here with an expert audience. I look forward to learning from them as well as sharing the panel up here some thoughts on what's happening in the Asia-Pacific region. You know, I was struck by Admiral Keating's overall tone of optimism, which I think is entirely appropriate. And yet I think that there are some looming issues that are not strategically resolved that we can delve into maybe in greater detail. And one of those has to do with the situation between China and Taiwan. As someone who's been traveling to China every year since 1984, I've witnessed the perturbations in China-Taiwan relations. And there's a certain constant, which is the economic engagement between the two has been growing steadily, especially over the last decade. But I wouldn't put so much confidence in the current goodwill and charm offensive going on between Taipei and Beijing. And I say that because I think that there are still some fundamental differences in long-term perspective between the people of Taiwan and the people of China about how the Taiwan question is going to be resolved and when and with what ultimate outcome. As we look at the future of China-Taiwan relations and how it's going to impact the U.S. security position in the Pacific, I wonder if we ought not to be focusing as much attention on building a strong security partnership with Taiwan as we are with reaching out to China to make sure that we remain balanced and in position to defend our security interests there. And we didn't hear quite as much about what we're doing with Taiwan in the security realm. Michael, during his tenure in government, was instrumental in helping to strengthen some of the defense connections that we have with Taiwan. We don't have an alliance. We're not going to have an alliance with Taiwan. But those security relationships are very important. I was also struck by the optimism with respect to the changes underway in Japan, and I share that optimism. I think there's a lot of teeth gnashing going on in certain sectors of Washington, worried about and uncertain about what the new government in Japan will mean for certain elements of the U.S.-Japan alliance. And I think that the strategic direction of Japan is clear, and I think the future of the alliance is sound. Some people say that this may complicate the Futenma base issue, to which I reply, well, gee, it's been pretty complicated the last 30 years, last time I checked. There hasn't been an easy resolution of basing issues on Okinawa, and it's not going to get any easier with a new government in Japan, which may wish to revisit some of the planning that's already taken place. But I'm hopeful that at the end of the day, as the Admiral said, that these issues will be resolved, and Marines will move to Guam, and our footprint in Japan will decrease, which will enhance our sustainability of the alliance. One issue that did not come up in the Admiral's presentation explicitly was Burma, and I was a little bit surprised that it didn't, but given the time constraints, maybe it's appropriate that it didn't. But Admiral Keating was on the ground in Burma, arguably the first sort of high-level mill-to-mill conversation that we've had there in the wake of the hurricane. And I think I share the view of many on Capitol Hill that our policy toward Burma has failed. But what is unclear is how it might be adjusted to become more effective. And there's a great debate, and there's no consensus on Capitol Hill about this. I think that in general people tend to support sanctions and pressure. I think that's fine. But sanctions and pressure without meaningful dialogue and opportunities for engagement to explore what may be possible in terms of change in Burma, I think the track record says that that's not going to work. And it especially doesn't work when you don't have any consensus among the major neighbors, China, India, Thailand. They don't agree with the U.S. approach. So we need to take a look at Burma, and it does pose real security issues for the region, because the refugee flow out of Burma, the risk of instability among the ethnic groups there is very significant. This is really a regional issue. It's not internal to Burma. So just a few things that Admiral touched on and some things that he didn't, where I had a few thoughts.
Thank you. We may come back to several of those, maybe arms sales to Taiwan, for example. Burma, 50-plus million people, not only human rights, democracy, humanitarian challenge, but now part of the proliferation puzzle. And Japan will have plenty to say about it, I think. Randy?
Thanks, Mike, and thanks to CSIS. I enjoyed the remarks and thought it was a very comprehensive address to our audience. I was struck by a couple things. I'd agree with Frank. I thought the Admiral had a very optimistic outlook. I suppose that's good. You want your combatant commander to be optimistic and to feel confident. But I think there are definitely some trend lines in unfolding in Asia that should have our attention very firmly, and I'm sure they have his, but maybe we're a bit understated given his outward optimism. I thought he did an excellent job of talking about some of the capabilities that the PLA is acquiring. He did focus on asymmetric capabilities, and I think that's the key element in China's acquisition strategy right now. He mentioned anti-satellite cyber. He didn't mention what I think is probably the most important system that is under development, if they're actually successful at it, is the anti-ship ballistic missile. But I thought it conveyed to me that Pacific Command is looking at the right things with respect to the PLA. One thing he didn't mention, which I think is just as important as how we prepare for a PLA that's modernizing and acquiring these capabilities, within the context of our mill-to-mill engagement, safety on the high seas, crisis communication, these things are essential. And perhaps it was just he was going quickly through the whole region and quickly through the China relationship, but I didn't hear specific mention of that. And I think that's probably the most important element. If the Chinese will engage with us in a meaningful way on the military-maritime consultative agreement, if they will send operators to the room and talk about safety issues and communication protocols, and if we can have reliable crisis communication that we can have confidence in rather than phone lines that don't get picked up in the event of an actual crisis, that would be extremely constructive, and I know it's something that Pacific Command and Admiral Keating himself have been involved in. Just a couple other things. I was struck a bit that Taiwan was not really mentioned until my friend John Zhang mentioned it in the Q&A, and I would underscore what Frank said. You know, if you think about it, the combatant commander of the Pacific Command has two op plans that he's really responsible for. Obviously, he's responsible for contingencies in the whole region, but he's obliged under law to have an op plan for Taiwan, and that seems to me would always be central to the commander's outlook with respect to the region. And we have a dynamic, I agree very much with Frank, it's not so certain that that trajectory can't be disrupted and we can't find ourselves in a different position a few years from now. And the key point to that whole dynamic is, of course, the PLA efforts opposite Taiwan haven't remained static. They've continued to build up opposite Taiwan. So, yes, diplomacy is underway. The environment is improving politically, but you have an increasingly complicated security situation with the PLA buildup continuing and Taiwan somewhat stalled in their own defense modernization. Just a couple other things, and these are sort of region-wide, not country-specific. I don't think he mentioned on his watch sort of the cost or the drag of the ongoing conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, unless I missed it. And it's my impression that that this has taken a significant amount of resources away from Pacific Command. It's obviously these are national priorities, and it's an all-hands-on-deck kind of effort when you're engaged in these kinds of activities. But I would have been curious to hear more about that dynamic on his watch and how and what implications that might have for the future. I think the point he made about the what was mentioned in the Australia Defense White Paper, some of the other buzz you hear about the region, about our staying power, is somewhat related to this. You know, yes, the U.S. has permanent forward presence and bases and allies and commitments, but some resources have been diverted. Will they come back? Will they come back in full strength? Will this be the same level of commitment that it's been in the past? I'm confident that it will be, but I just didn't hear the commander expand on that. And then leave it to the Republican to raise the fuzzy global issue, but I didn't hear any mention of climate change or any of these sort of non-traditional security issues. Little mention of energy in the context of talking about the Strait of Malacca, but I think the impact of climate change in Asia will be particularly significant, particularly given the Arctic ice melt and what that could mean for resource competition, maritime boundaries, maritime domain awareness, even reduced transit times between the Pacific and other theaters. So that would have been interesting to hear a little bit about. But again, I'm the press of time and all the things he did cover in his excellent address are probably to explain that. But thank you.
Good. Thank you, and it's great to be here. You know, as a journalist, what I was struck by was the same thing all these other analysts are struck by, was the sense of sort of optimism about the admiral's statements. And I assure you, 4 or 5 years ago, and I got the briefing from the Pacific commander back then, it was a much less optimistic assessment. China was building up massive numbers of surface-to-surface missiles across the Taiwan Strait. There was huge amounts of bellicose rhetoric going on. There was white papers being written in China about, you know, the cross-strait invasion of Taiwan. It was really a bad time. It was an absolutely different sort of briefing than we just got here. And I actually, at the risk of saying some sort of pretty obvious things, think there may be a teachable moment here, so I'm going to go ahead and say them anyway. You know, the admiral said, well, our policy hasn't changed since 1979 and the One China policy. Well, anyone, and I'm sure almost everyone in this room knows there's a huge tension within that One China policy between those who thought we should be closer to Taiwan and make our sort of support for Taiwan much more explicit, and those who thought, you know, engagement with China over a long term was the way to go. And that way you draw them into the international system. Well, you know, we saw with the first Bush term, not the second, but the first Bush term, people in positions of power who thought the former, that we should make our support for Taiwan much more explicit, President Bush himself came out and tried almost remove the ambiguity from the One China policy by saying we would come to Taiwan's defense. Very explicit things. We had the big arms package that went further than any other arms package to Taiwan with submarines, et cetera, even though they were never delivered or bought. And China got its back up. It's got its back up in a very serious way. And it seems to me that where we are now with, I recall back in that time, you know, there is a certain check we've written to Taiwan in the One China policy. But, you know, what we saw when you got that much overt support, it seemed to me, was they saw it as a check that was already signed, and they could fill in the amount. They had when Secretary of State then Colin Powell resisted some of this, was seen as sort of resisting the neocons in the Bush administration in the first term. The Taiwanese government put a full page ad in the Washington Post criticizing our Secretary of State for being not on board with the new American direction. I mean, I'd never seen anything like that in my life, and I don't think either had Colin Powell. He was very upset about that. So I think that there is we've seen that that path has its own risk, and I'm sure some of my panel members will probably disagree with me on this. But this assessment, the fact that Taiwan and China are talking again, that there's less bellicose rhetoric, the fact that Taiwan is not pushing the boundaries of independence quite so overtly, has led to a position where China has backed off. I was at a breakfast before with Admiral Keating before this event, and he said that, you know, the pace of those deployments across the Taiwan Straits, although they have not been removed, has slowed considerably in this, as the waters have cooled. So I think that's a positive thing, and I think there's probably, like I said, a teachable moment in here about, I mean, we talk about getting closer to military cooperation with Taiwan. That's fine, but we should also understand that China views this as a zero-sum game. So if you're going to do that, you have to calculate in what's that going to do with your relationship to China. Now, maybe there's a quid pro quo you can throw in there, but don't think that you can get closer and closer military ties to Taiwan and not upset China, because we've learned that is impossible to do. It doesn't mean you shouldn't do them, but it means you should take that calculation and that understanding into the equation. And just very briefly, I mean, I agreed with most of the optimistic assessments with our partnerships in the region. Japan, you know, I've been there and went through this whole discussion with this whole new footprint. I think that it has a lot of positive implications to it. I think, you know, to Japan, we really are the indispensable partner. They really have no other partner. So a new government may come in and say it's going to tweak the relationship, but this only so far they will go, because they're not going to cozy up to China for obvious reasons. And they are concerned about the rapid growth of China's, not only its economy, but its military. Actually, I think probably the signature success of the Bush administration's foreign policy in Asia was its rapprochement with India. Ties are much stronger there, and that relationship has definitely improved in the last 8 years. Australia, again, very strong. South Korea, very rocky. This whole time when we were sort of seeming to tilt more towards Taiwan, and relationships with China suffered. We saw our relationship with South Korea suffer, too. They are very uncomfortable about being seen as becoming between us and China. I think that relationship now is on a firmer footing. The one, obviously, net negative is North Korea. They were not a nuclear power 8 years ago. They are a nuclear power now. I have not seen anything to suggest that we've solved the issue of North Korea. Maybe it's unsolvable. Maybe, you know, the best you can do is try to contain it. I think that's probably, for the foreseeable future, it probably is the best you can do. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, James. Small trivia point. The author of that Washington Post article criticizing Colin Powell on Taiwan policy was stuck in the Dulles Airport ANA business class lounge with me, Randy Shriver, and Rich Armitage the day it appeared. And if you've seen Rich Armitage, you generally don't want to piss him off. So he came up very sheepishly and apologized for causing trouble, and then Rich dropped a safe on his head. Now, Rich was very gracious. Well, there are a couple things we'll want to focus on before we open it up. I think Taiwan is front and center. I should emphasize, I think the consensus on the panel is Admiral Keating's strategic priorities were right on target. As I mentioned briefly earlier, we've done polling among elites in Asia here at CSIS, and I think other polling done of public opinion shows that the U.S. position in Asia is stronger today after his tenure than ever before, which is a credit to his efforts and the Pacific Command. And besides, we're think tankers. We're in the glass half-empty business. And much of what we've just heard is in many ways really things that are going to be on the plate for Admiral Willard after October. So I want to look forward at some of those issues. Taiwan. We spent some time on Taiwan. Let's do another round. I'd be curious what people think about this issue of arms sales and how we manage relations with the PRC. Admiral Keating rightly pointed out that it's a national command decision and the Pacific Command has input but doesn't make the call. Admiral Willard will have to make some input. The delta in capabilities across the straits is growing. And Taiwan's F-5s are quite old. On the other hand, you have the president going to China in November. You have, you know, the example of mill-to-mill being interrupted by past arms sales. I'd be curious how, from congressional and regional perspectives, how you see this playing out over the coming year when Admiral Willard comes onto the job.
Let me start off, and then Randy and James have a lot of expertise on this as well. I think the key thing to understand about the Taiwan-China military balance is that no amount of arms sales to Taiwan is ever going to give Taiwan the capability to defeat China. So on the one hand, the entire exercise is one of deterrence. It's one of trying to ensure that the Taiwanese are a hard enough target that the Chinese are dissuaded from any adventurism. So having said that, you know, you look at the arms package that's already been approved for sale to Taiwan and the fact that Taiwan has not yet proceeded to fully implement that package. And I think a reasonable person would say now is not the time to be rushing into new arms sales to Taiwan. Let's see how Taiwan does in integrating the packages that they've already purchased, completing those purchases, and then make an assessment. So I don't think the administration is under immediate time pressure, notwithstanding Taiwan's obvious interest in the F-16 CDs, in making any dramatic new decisions about arms sales to Taiwan. But it's a decision which will be made, as the Admiral said, at the highest level, and a decision made according to law, and the law, relevant law, is the Taiwan Relations Act, which is an interesting law because it is very clear in what should or should not be taken into account with respect to Taiwan arms sales. And what should not be taken into account is China's inevitable objections to any and all such sales. And so what we have to do is try to make an assessment as to how to best secure our national security interests with respect to arms sales in Taiwan. And reasonable people can disagree. I'm not hearing on Capitol Hill a groundswell of pressure on the Obama administration to do more on arms sales to Taiwan. I think that people look at the political rapprochement that is underway between Beijing and Taipei, and they take some comfort from that. But what I meant to say earlier was simply that, you know, intentions can change faster than capabilities, and the delta on the capabilities is clear. China's capabilities are growing much faster than Taiwan's. The obsolescence, in particular, of Taiwan's Air Force is already a real issue, and it's only going to get worse. But I think for the United States, we have to figure out how best to promote peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait, and arms sales are only one component of that. There's a whole political strategy involved. There's also mill-to-mill engagement with China that can be used to help mitigate the risks and reduce the threat. So just drawing on my historical perspective, I would say that we've seen a real change on Capitol Hill from when I started there in 1997, at a time when you had Jesse Helms as chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, when you had a much, much more skeptical Congress when it looked at China and its intentions vis-a-vis Taiwan, and a Congress that was much more quick to jump toward getting closer with Taiwan in the defense sector. I think today people understand that the people of Taiwan, the government of Taiwan itself, are trying to reach out to Beijing and reduce tension. And I think that ultimately we need to take our lead somewhat from the people of Taiwan and have an appreciation for the wisdom that they have in how to deal with China. But final thought on this, Michael, is just that, you know, the people of Taiwan themselves are of mixed opinion, right, about how to deal with China. And again, Ma Ying-jeou's approach, while it enjoys broad support in general, this idea of tension reduction, when you go beyond and you start talking about the final political settlement of the Taiwan question, there's no consensus on Taiwan and how to proceed. And I think most people tend to support the status quo. So again, we're in a window right now of relatively low tension. I think that window is going to remain open for several more years. But as you start moving toward a long-term horizon, it's much much more difficult to see how this question gets resolved.
Randy, do you want to?
I'll just add very quickly. I agree with most of what Frank said. Maybe I fall in the category of an unreasonable person because I think there is a little more sense of urgency to what we should be doing to support Taiwan. I think there's at least two cuts to the analysis. One is the straight sort of legal interpretation of the Taiwan Relations Act, which in my mind couldn't be more clear that we are under an obligation to make systems available to Taiwan, whether or not they buy them. I agree with Frank. It's up to Taiwan. But given the threat, given the continued buildup, and if I heard what you said correctly, there's an inclination to give the Chinese credit for slowing the pace of the buildup, but the buildup is continuing. I think that's in and of itself a pretty remarkable thing, given the diplomacy and the improved political environment, and the fact that Taiwan has essentially taken an acquisition holiday, that the PRC buildup is continuing. So to me, the legal requirement is crystal clear. But the second cut is really a philosophical cut. And it has always been the position of the United States that our arms sales to Taiwan are not a deterrent to cross-strait interactions or diplomacy. It's actually to help Taiwan to have the confidence to go to the negotiating table and to engage in diplomacy in a consequential way without a gun to their head. So our arms sales are actually supportive of cross-strait diplomacy. And if you look at the actual historical record, despite all the protests and accusations that these are obstacles to dialogue, in fact, there's almost no correlation. And if there is a correlation, it's actually in the other direction. Our largest single arms sales package in the history of the U.S.-Taiwan relationship was the 1992 F-16 sales, which were shortly followed by Guwang talks and two rounds of cross-strait diplomacy. Ma Ying-jeou himself has said, we need F-16s. Don't let us manage the cross-strait dynamic. We need these aircraft for defense, but let us manage the cross-strait diplomacy. And I would certainly take him at his word and have confidence that he can do that. So to me, it's a little more clear and there's a little more urgency to this matter, but maybe I'm the outlier here.
Go ahead. Do you want to weigh in on this one? One of the things that struck me was the Admiral's comments on North Korea, and I found it very, reassuring and important that he emphasized certifiable denuclearization, and I think the administration deserves credit for not straying from that goal and from not falling for buying the same horse twice. But it also struck me when asked about the if I understood the answer correctly, the military implications, the Admiral's response was, we watch it very, very closely. But it didn't seem to have any significant impact on our thinking about military strategy vis-a-vis the North Korean threat. By the way, we'll have Skip Sharp here in this forum, and perhaps we can announce that at the end. I forget the exact date. So he'll be able to answer these questions himself. But 2012 is the date when we're supposed to transfer wartime operational command to the ROK. 2012 is also the date that the North Koreans have repeatedly stated will be their coming out as a full nuclear weapon state. There are debates in Japan about the credibility of U.S. extended deterrence after the nuclear test in North Korea and some similar discussions in South Korea. Is Admiral Willard, is the next Pacific commander, the next commander of U.S. Forces Korea, going to have to think a little differently about our military strategy vis-a-vis North Korea in terms of a different kind of threat and then different kind of reassurance we have to give our allies? I'll open that up, James. Maybe you can take a first stab at it.
It's an interesting question. I actually think that it changes the equation. How can it not change the equation when you're confronting a very unpredictable hermetic regime that now has nuclear weapons that has proliferated everything it's ever had and apparently was building a nuclear facility in Syria? and you know, apparently also willing to sell nuclear technologies to Burma. So yeah, it does change our calculation. It emphasizes actually your. I mean, and this came out in the breakfast before too that Admiral Keating's very happy to have some level of missile defense now. You would think that would be something that he would, you know, the next Pacific commander would want more of. Absolutely. I think it would want you to strengthen the number of ties and informal arrangements that are part of our proliferation security initiative so you can do things like they just did in turning this North Korean ship around, using those UN resolutions to say, you know, you're not actually allowed to do this stuff. You know, there's never been a good military option on the Korean Peninsula. It's gotten significantly worse now they've got nuclear weapons. In fact, it's so bad that it's very hard to imagine you're in anything but a containment deterrent situation until or unless you come to some breakthrough in six-party talks that no one I talk to thinks is imminent.
Just briefly on DPRK. Nobody in Washington ever lost any money betting against a resolution of the North Korean problem. And unfortunately, I think this president's tenure in office, whether it's 4 years or 8 years, he's going to have to deal with North Korea. As Bill Perry says, he's going to have to deal with it as it is and not as we would wish it to be. And what it is a limited nuclear capability, which greatly complicates everything that we're trying to do on the peninsula. It affects our deterrence posture. It does, I think, require some adjustment and reassurance to our allies to make sure that they do not in any way lose confidence in our extended nuclear deterrence. And it definitely requires a nonproliferation emphasis by the United States in concert with other countries. It's very significant that South Korea has joined PSI. They were cooperating with us before, but they're cooperating with us at a new level. It's significant that China has begun to interdict movement of sensitive materials across the border with North Korea. I've walked along that border. I've watched the trucks go across at Yenbian. There's an awful lot that moves across that border. None of it moves across the border in trucks without the Chinese knowing about it. And if they are being more vigilant now, as I believe they are, that's a very, very encouraging sign, and I think it sends the right message to Pyongyang. But the DPRK, is there any hope? I mean, 2012 is the 100th anniversary, I guess, of the birth of Kim Il-sung. The North Koreans are sensitive to these dates. I think they'd very much like to realign themselves. North Korean officials talk about the reset button that Hillary Clinton pushed with the Russians. I think they'd like to reset the game in Northeast Asia. They'd like to be accepted as a nuclear power. That's not going to happen. But their desire to reconfigure their relationships with the United States, with South Korea, with Japan, with China, I think we need to explore that, try to see whether or not we can leverage it to convince them to move back onto the path of denuclearization. Like I said, no one lost any money betting against resolution, but, you know, it doesn't make any sense to cease our efforts in this regard. And I think Admiral Keating gave you a very clear explanation of where the administration is. I don't think their goals have changed. And I do expect that sometime in the next few weeks we're going to see a resumption of dialogue with North Korea. But whether or not that dialogue will, in fact, bring them back to the multilateral table or not remains to be seen.
We should never be in the business of encouraging North Koreans to push buttons of any kind. I flagged the wartime OPCON because my own personal bias in this one is that we should be reconsidering how we do that. And I think there are very strongly held views in South Korea, represented in 10 million signatures in a national petition, that maybe this isn't a good idea. On the other hand, and we'll probably get into this deeper when General Sharp is here. We've made progress. We've demonstrated we can do some of this. So it doesn't mean we turn the clock back to 2006 or 7, but we, in my view, need to be thinking a little bit harder about how we sell this and how we package it and some of the some of the possible losses of capability that come when you reduce jointness, which is part of what's happening. So for another day, let me ask about New Zealand. I want to ask Randy, because Randy's written on this and worked on New Zealand, as did I. The Admiral promised to answer questions about New Zealand. It was very tantalizing, and then he escaped. Is it possible that under Admiral Willard we'll be talking about a U.S.-New Zealand alliance again?
I think it's first of all, I love talking about New Zealand. We get the New Zealand caucus together, all five of us, on occasion, and I think it's very, very unlikely you're going to be talking about an alliance. It's, I think, extremely likely you'll see a continued trajectory of closer ties and more interaction between the United States and New Zealand and other parties. And I think the sort of conceptual framework is moving in the direction of an all-but alliance. The policies made sense when the United States put the alliance in abeyance in 1986. They make sense today, in my view. It is inappropriate to have a full military alliance with all those commitments and obligations that come with it if you can't actually implement it. It's inconceivable that we could come to New Zealand's defense and that would include natural disaster and humanitarian crisis. It's inconceivable we could do so without the use of some nuclear power. So it's, in my view, it continues to be appropriate to hold the actual alliance in abeyance. But we're talking about New Zealand doing things that in our direct interest, in our very highest national priorities. They've sent troops to Afghanistan, continue to have a presence. They've contributed to reconstruction in Iraq. They've contributed to anti-piracy, and they've contributed to stability operations in the Pacific Islands. These are all things that contribute directly to our interests and therefore suggest we should not remove this as an obstacle because it's not going to be removed, but find a way to strengthen our relationship with New Zealand in appropriate ways that allow us to be better positioned to meet mutual objectives, mutual goals. I think John Key is of that mind, and I think the Obama administration officials with whom I've spoken are also of the same mind. So I'm pretty optimistic about this, but not a full alliance at any point on their watch would be my guess.
Thanks, Randy. I think we have time for some questions. Is that right? Yeah, so we'll take questions and comments from the floor. If you could use the mic, identify yourself. I think we're willing to take two questions if you want. Sir.
Hi, Yochi Driesen from the Wall Street Journal. Frank, can you talk a bit, the Admiral's comments about trying to get some of the restrictions on aid to the Indonesian Special Operations Forces. Can you talk both about what those restrictions are currently and also how far along the process of lifting them actually is? Thanks.
Sure, I'm happy to address that. Congress imposed restrictions on IMET training with Indonesia because of human rights concerns about the Indonesian armed forces, especially their conduct in East Timor, but also more generally. And 2 years ago, I believe it was, or at least almost 2 years ago, Congress lifted or granted the administration waiver authority to lift almost all of those restrictions. And the administration did so on the very first day that waiver authority became operational. And Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Eric John came up to the Hill and said, look, we're going to proceed now with training for the Indonesian Armed Forces because of the improvements that have been made under SBY on accountability and rule of law, and also because of the imperatives in enhancing our cooperation with Indonesia in a whole host of security areas, especially in counterterrorism. Congress remains concerned, especially about the conduct of COPASIS. There remain unanswered questions about COPASIS's conduct, not only in East Timor, but also in West Papua. And so we are working through with the Indonesian government some of these questions. And really, the senator who's taken the lead on this is Senator Leahy, Patrick Leahy of Vermont. He has, as I understand it, a couple of letters that have been written to the Indonesian government requesting some additional information with respect to COPASIS's conduct that have not been answered or sufficiently answered. And he's working with the administration to try to establish some benchmarks that would lead to the resumption of full normal mill-to-mill relations with Indonesia. But I want to highlight, you know, two things. One is that, you know, the remaining restrictions with respect to Kopassus have not significantly impacted a whole slew of things that we're doing with Indonesia, whether it's counter-piracy, whether it's anti-extremist training and law enforcement cooperation. You know, we're doing more with them now than ever. And the second point is that I think there is a willingness on the part of those members of Congress who are most adamant that the questions about Kopassus be answered. There's a willingness to observe Indonesia's conduct, to observe the prosecution of those generals and other officers who may be directly responsible for human rights abuses in East Timor, and to judge Indonesia by their actions. And I think there's also a much higher confidence now on the part of many members of Congress in the government of Indonesia and in SBY's efforts to reform the leadership of the armed forces of Indonesia. And this gives, I think, the Congress increasingly confidence that the remaining restrictions, you know, can be lifted in the foreseeable future. But I wouldn't want to hazard a date. And I think that it's important to understand that the restrictions that were put in place for a reason, and that those reasons remain valid.
In the frontier.
Peter Sharfman, Miter Corporation. Admiral Keating referred repeatedly to countries in the region viewing the United States as an indispensable partner. But the exception to that, perhaps, is China, which views the United States as certainly powerful and important, but not necessarily indispensable. Could you look a little bit further into the future, years rather than months, and talk about the implications of that?
Well, I think there's great ambivalence actually in China. I think if you really press them, they acknowledge that it's actually been U.S. presence and U.S. alliances that have created regional stability such that they've been allowed to focus on their internal development and do all the things that they want to do to become a greater power. But I do think if they look out beyond the horizon, they would primarily see the U.S. as a complicating factor to many things they want to do. I think they don't necessarily have a near-term plan to try to actively supplant the United States or drive the United States out of the region, but I think a lot of their diplomacy is designed not only to improve their own lie, in the Gulf sense, improve their lie, but essentially the beginning of a game for influence and a sort of protracted effort to be the premier regional power. I don't know if they have a timeline of when they can get there, but the timeline, in fact, would be a sort of complicated calculation because they're watching the United States. Are we going to pull ourselves out of the game? And I think there were questions in the second term of the Bush administration. Were we diverted in a way that was going to have sort of permanent consequences? Would we reconstitute in Asia in a meaningful way and so forth? But I think, you know, their desire is to have the range of movement and range of freedom in their diplomacy and in their military affairs in a way that's less complicated by the U.S., and that's a long-term objective. To me, it's pretty clear. But in the short term, again, there's ambivalence because they see that this has actually served them quite well in terms of keeping peace and stability in Asia, keeping Japan from remilitarizing. At least that's how they see it, not necessarily how we see it. But so it's been a near-term benefit to them, but over the long term, I think they would see us more as a complicating factor to their objectives.
Let me weigh in. I think, as you know, there's a great deal of attention to this idea of a G2. That's been put out, not by the administration, but by very prominent people like Bob Zoellick and others, that the U.S. and China would manage the global economy, manage other challenges like climate change together. It's a deeply unpopular idea in Europe and Japan and India and Australia. It's also kind of unpopular in Beijing, I find at least, because they don't want to have to take on that responsibility. So not much will happen there. On the other hand, gravitation towards a bipolar condominium in Asia, where Beijing has an effective veto or works out major security issues with the United States, has attraction, I think, for a lot of Chinese strategic thinkers, because you have the benefit of having some U.S. presence with all that that brings, but you have some control over how much the Americans can shape the security environment. I think one of the delicate balances, one of the challenges for the Pacific Command is to encourage bilateral cooperation with China, encourage the sense that we have not zero-sum relationships, but that we can build win-win relationships, while at the same time not conveying the impression that we're interested in a bipolar condominium in Asia. And the best way to do that is to do exactly what Admiral Keating did, which is to start your talk with our ally Japan, our ally Australia, and so forth, which is why he spends so much time traveling to Tokyo and to Japan and elsewhere. I also have to say I find it fascinating that the Chinese strategic elites' assessments of power fluctuate wildly. After the Gulf, the original, the 1991 Gulf War, we were 10 feet tall. But then in Somalia, we were, a waning power. And then in Bosnia, we were suddenly 10 feet tall again in 98. And so the Chinese assessment of our power, at least in the public literature, seems to go way up and way down. Right now, I think the assessment is on a fairly low ebb about our power. But the Chinese often overassess their own power. There was a poll done by the Chicago Council on Global Affairs on soft power. One of the questions was, what country in Asia is best at representing their interests and has the most influence? And across the region, it wasn't every country in the region, it was about six countries, but in every one of those six countries, the U.S. was assessed as having the highest influence and actually having increased influence over the last 10 years. Interestingly, China was the only country where that view was not held, and the Chinese public view was that China had the most influence and had increased its influence. This is on soft power. So sometimes our Chinese friends, while very strategic, don't assess accurately, in my view, at least in the public literature and in polling, their own power, our power. And in that sense, the Pacific Command has a very important shaping function to reassure but also remind how the distribution of power and influence in Asia really lies. Did you want to?
Yeah. Just briefly, and maybe James too, but I want to point out something which I know the gentleman knows, but which is sometimes not front and center in the minds of members of the general public, which is that for the Chinese leadership, when they wake up each morning, they're not thinking about, well, gee, how do we kick the Americans out of Asia? They're thinking about how do we deal with our energy security, how do we deal with an aging population, how do we deal with the environmental nightmare, how do we deal with the need to sustain high-level economic growth, how do we deal with our ethnic unrest in 40% of our landmass in Xinjiang and Tibet, where all of our critical minerals are, where 50% of the world's hydroelectric power is, where the headwaters of the seven great rivers of Asia are. If water is the next oil, then Tibet is the next Saudi Arabia, and the Chinese have real problems in Tibet and in Xinjiang. So I think that I generally agree with Randy, and with Michael, that the Chinese are somewhat ambivalent about the U.S. presence, that they see advantages and complicating factors. But I just want to emphasize that it's not their top priority, sort of thinking, well, gee, how do we expand our influence at the expense of the Americans? They're focused on their domestic affairs. And one of the things that I'm heartened by with respect to the Obama administration is that you've seen a very concerted effort to show up in the Asia-Pacific region early. Secretary Clinton made her first visit to Tokyo. Obama is going to head to the region. You saw that Secretary Clinton not only went to Tokyo, but then she went to Jakarta, and she formalized the U.S. decision to join the TAC, the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation, to be a joiner, to be present, to establish a closer relationship with ASEAN. I think this is very clearly a kind of a balancing act with respect to Chinese influence in the region. So I think the United States is in Asia. We're going to stay in Asia. I think the Chinese, for now, fully accept that reality. Whether they have long-term plans to try to supplant us or certainly to enhance their own prestige and influence in the region, I'm sure they do want to do the latter. I'm less sure about the former. They clearly want to enhance their own prestige, influence, power in the region. But I don't think that's their top priority. Their top priority for now and for the near term is focusing on these domestic challenges, which are formidable. And they need us to address each and every one of those domestic issues. And they also need our market, and they need our technology, our expertise, and our assistance. And if they can transfer and continue to have us shoulder a lot of the burden for regional security and stability, I think they're happy to do that for now.
Can I just to back that up, I mean, we may not be the indispensable partner for China, but I think we are their indispensable market. And that's what I find interesting, because why everyone focuses on Taiwan, if you take Taiwan off the table, if those tensions don't exist, the chance of short-term sort of conflict with China start to disappear. Because if you do look, they are very strategic. They look very long-term. And their long-term goals, through the teens anyway, is to solidify this sort of economic miracle that they're riding. And it seems to me during those times, the way our economic relationship works, which is strategically very unbalanced right now, but how it develops may be the most strategic thing that happens between us and China.
Yes, sir. In the back.
I'm Kazef Uwasara from TV Asahi, Japanese TV. I want to ask Frank on a DPRK issue. Recently, State Department made clear that the U.S. were prepared to have bilateral talk with DPRK in the context of six-party talks. But regarding these direct talks, some, including me, have concerns that the six-party talks may be the opportunity only to admit or confirm the agreement between U.S. and DPRK. How do you think about this concern?
Well, you know, we spend a lot of time worrying about the shape of the table when we talk about North Korea and the efforts to engage North Korea. I think history teaches that you need a combination of direct bilateral contact and multilateral talks. Every member of the six-party talks, except for the United States, has had a summit meeting with North Korea. Every member around that table has extensive direct channels of communication, although the Japan DPRK channel has been moribund for a while, but there's some indications that may start up again as well. And the North-South relationship ebbs and flows depending on the mood of the day. So we need both. Direct talks and multilateral talks. There can't be a solution without everyone's involvement. The North Korean nuclear program is a threat not just to U.S. interests, but to the entire region. So it's appropriate that there be multilateral talks. Now, North Korea says that the talks are dead, the six-party talks are dead. I say long live the hexagonal table talks. We may have to have a new name, but I can't imagine how we solve the problem without the involvement, first and foremost, of our treaty ally, the Republic of Korea, but more generally with the involvement of Japan and China and Russia. So I'm not trying to dodge your question, but I don't think it's an either-or, bilateral talks or multilateral. I think that you can and must do both, and I think at the end of the day, the North Koreans may see some advantage in a multilateral format. They don't trust us. They don't believe that our governments, from administration to administration, from Congress to Congress, are reliable interlocutors. One of the ways to enhance their confidence may be to have essentially international guarantors of any arrangement that can be worked out. And so I would hope that the North Koreans would see it as in their interest to see other partners involved. From a congressional perspective, I can promise you Congress doesn't want to pay for the inevitable billions that a successful nuclear deal with North Korea are going to cost. The American people don't want to pay all of that cost. We need to share that burden broadly. Even New Zealand recently has contributed financially to efforts to resolve the North Korean nuclear crisis. And as a representative of the Congress, I would say, you know, many hands make light work. So let's involve as many partners as we can. And And you know, maybe we get the 6+1, we get Mongolia in there. But I think there's a way to proceed on this that involves both the bilateral discussions, which are important, and multilateral.
I remember working in the NSC staff when Mongolia announced it was going to send troops to Iraq. The prime minister said to the president, Mongolia has a history with Iraq. We have a history with reconstruction. Of course, several hundred years ago, they sacked Baghdad and piled skulls. They have a history with Korea. They have a history with Korea, too. Maybe that would be useful. We have time, I think, for one or two more in the back.
Yeon Ho Kim with Voice of America. Another question about North Korea. There has been a couple of cases where the UN sanctions against North Korea were successfully implemented, including Gangnam, a North Korean ship returning to North Korea after closely monitored by U.S. Navy, and North Korean weapons captured at UAE. But I was wondering if this, you know, non-proliferation efforts or monitoring suspicious shipments going in and out of North Korea is effectively implemented, especially when it comes to our partnership with China, given the fact that a lot of North Korea's outbound shipment goes through China, and wondering if you have any thoughts on that. Thank you.
I'm going to ask the others to contribute as well on this question, because Randy and has a lot of operational experience that I don't have in this field. But I would say that I was in China with Senator Kerry on the day that North Korea detonated their second nuclear device. And I've never seen the Chinese officials more upset. And I think the cooperation we've seen out of China since then has been a whole order of magnitude better than anything we've seen prior to that second nuclear test. And the Chinese have even named individuals who are now unwelcome to travel to China. This is an unprecedented step for the Chinese to take. And these officials in North Korea's nuclear establishment, goes without saying, there are not a lot of direct air flights into Pyongyang. And if you can't fly to Beijing or Shenyang, to get out of that place, and if you can't take a train to Beijing, and you're a North Korean official engaged in proliferation activities, you're out of business. So I think the Chinese are taking this more seriously than ever, and I think the United States is taking it more seriously than ever before. And I just want to comment that it was a great moment to be an American when President Obama ordered the John McCain, under the command of Captain Kim, to trace this North Korean vessel. Only in the United States would you have a president, the likes of Obama, a ship named after a family of public servants and naval officers, the McCain, under the command of a Korean-American captain, chasing after a North Korean proliferation arms smuggler. So I took some enormous pleasure as an American at that moment, and I think that you can count on the administration to very vigorously enforce the UN resolutions that are in place against North Korea now. And hopefully that sends a message that the North Koreans will understand that pressure is not going away until they change course.
I might have a just slightly different view. It's not necessarily in contradiction, but I think there's a shorthand that we fall into sometimes when we talk about the United States and China and how we look at the Korean Peninsula. And the shorthand is we have common interests, and this is something we're working on hand in glove and so forth. And I think it's a bit more complicated than that. I think we have common aversions. I think we have a set of common challenges, but I think it's far from being a situation where we have common interests, because the interests are, in fact, quite different. And the reason that's consequential, when you get to the point where you decide what you're going to do about it, you often diverge in directions. And I think it's really incumbent upon the Obama administration, others involved in this, to keep that frame of mind with respect to China, because we're now into the second decade of this. You know, is China doing all they can to pressure North Korea? Are they using all means necessary? North Korea is so reliant on China. No country has more influence in North Korea than China. But yet, you know, here we are. China is still propping up the regime through their economic support and through other kinds of support. And it's my view that China is perfectly willing to live with a nuclear-armed North Korea as long as some of their other primary objectives are secured. It's not necessarily their preference or the most optimal outcome, but when they look at sort of trade-offs and what they can live with and what they can't, I think they come down fundamentally in a different place than we do. Does that mean we can work with them? I think we can still work with them, but we have to always be vigilant in our assessment of what China is after and what we can expect from them. I do think it's, you know, what the Admiral said about our goal and what others say about our goal about complete, verifiable, certifiable denuclearization is the proper goal of the United States. But I think we have to be sober-minded that talking North Korea out of their nuclear weapons is going to be damn hard, and particularly under this regime. And I think if we really do shift our priorities toward counterproliferation, nonproliferation, to contingency preparation, first and foremost with our allies, but with China included, and then we start asking things of the Chinese and others, I think we can get somewhere. It was my experience, Frank was kind enough to mention my operational experience. It was my experience, if you came to the Chinese with very specific information on a very specific case and said, this is your problem, do something about it, they generally would. They generally would also like to know, well, how do you know that? What's the and try to get a little peek into our intelligence capabilities and how we glean the information that we had. But generally speaking, you know, they don't want this stuff run through their territory. They don't want to be sort of the outlier as the pariah state that's allowing proliferation of nuclear materials and so forth. So if you bring them a specific problem, a specific task, my experience has been they'll do something about it. But I just think we need to define the goals in a way that's realistic and place expectations on the Chinese that are also realistic given what their real set of interests are.
My sense is that the U.S. official dialogue with China and certainly the think tank and Chatterati classes, dialogue with Chinese think tankers and officials, is dominated these days by the Chinese telling us we need to come back to the table, we need bilateral talks. It's all about the shape of the table and the diplomacy. Frank's right. The PRC has never cooperated to this extent on implementing sanctions, specifically 1874, the Security Council resolution that was passed after the last nuclear test. And they have done specific actions. They've cooperated. But as Randy points out, it's to the letter of the law, not the spirit of the resolution. And I think it's going to be important for all of us, official and unofficial, to talk to the Chinese government to make it clear how central the two issues Randy mentioned, one, instability scenarios, and then the second is this proliferation problem, how central they are to the U.S. interests and to U.S.-China relations. And that we're not interested in spending 90% of our time talking about how to get a bilateral meeting going and how to shape the table. My personal expectation is that the transfer issue, that proliferation is going to be a growth industry for North Korean challenges to us. In 2003, I was with Jim Kelly in Beijing. We had a dinner and the North Koreans pulled us aside and on instructions from Pyongyang said, very clearly, we have a nuclear deterrent if the U.S. doesn't end its hostile policy, which, by the way, is pretty much us being us. It's a long, long list with our alliances, sanctions, our nuclear umbrella, the list goes on. If we didn't end our hostile policy, they would demonstrate their deterrent, they would expand their deterrent, and they would transfer their deterrent. This was in 2003, and we now know that around that time they were already reprocessing and expanding their deterrent. They, a few years later, demonstrated their deterrent with a nuclear test, and we now know from the Syria case, and although I don't know the details, possibly the Burma case, that they've transferred some capability. And I think that transfer piece is going to continue to vex us. First of all, they paid almost no consequence for what happened in Syria, so the dissuasion strategy we've deployed has been pretty ineffective so far. The Burma case is a little more effective, to the extent we know about it. Second, they know that a red line is very hard for us to define. Rich Armitage, others have said, transfer is a red line. What does that mean? Is helping Syria develop the capability a red line? Well, if it is, we didn't do anything. Transferring fissile material? Well, maybe that is. But I think they have an interest, and in fact it's their MO, to steer short of what they think our red line is and test it. And they'll do that because they get from it horizontal escalation. They can demonstrate to us what they can do to us, which from their perspective is deterrence. They'll do it because, as they have stated very clearly to Frank and me and others, and publicly, they're interested in arms control negotiations with the U.S. as a fellow nuclear weapons state on containing transfer and proliferation, comparable to what we did with India. So they want to get rewards for it. So I think this is a real challenge. And from that perspective, we are just beginning to catch up to the problem. And China's way, way behind. And I think we all of us need to make it clear to China how crucial their cooperation is and that it's not adequate, even though, as Frank said, it's more than they've ever done. I apologize for taking the last word. This has been, for all of us, I think, on the panel, an interesting discussion. I hope for you, too. I want to thank General Helston, Rolls-Royce North America. This is a terrific opportunity, these forums. Thank you very much for sponsoring them. And thank you, everyone, for coming to CSIS today.